This is a Power 98.7 podcast. Now we're talking. Subscribe to Power 98.7 podcasts in iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. There's more on power987.co.za.
5 minutes after nine, we did say earlier on that we'll be speaking to the CEO of an organization called Safer South Africa Foundation. But you know her as a former National Police Commissioner, Ria Piega. Good evening to you, ma'am. How are you?
Good evening, Tabi. And how are you? I am great, great, great.
Yeah, you look in good spirits. It's good.
Thank you very much, and good evening to your listeners.
Women's Month, by the way, is it something that excites you, or do you think it's something that we need to reflect on differently?
Absolutely. Actually, yesterday I was preaching because it was our first Sunday for Women's Month. I really do believe that it's a special opportunity for us women just to reflect, really.
Yeah.
And to look into the role of women.
Yeah.
In our country.
Yeah.
And to look at the opportunities.
Yeah.
That are required for women to make a difference.
Yeah.
Because you would know that we have been particularly left out in a number of things.
Yes.
And I think celebration of Women's Month is quite a key space for us to have very profound conversations around our role in a multiplicity of environments.
Yeah, because women are really under siege. I mean, stats they say last week say that mostly it's women who are unemployed. Violence against women is something that goes on unabated as well. Opportunities, you know, still coming in drips and drabs for women, whether it's in the business sector and everywhere else, and so on and so forth. So, but we need, how do we then change the gear on the reflection? Because I think we've been reflecting for quite a while.
I think we need to really start thinking harder. And it's not just in South Africa. By the way, it is globally.
Mm.
If the largest economy, such as the US, for all the space that they've had, many, many years, haven't been able to produce one single woman president.
Mm.
It tells you a story.
Yeah, that there's a long way to go.
Precisely.
Yeah.
And even if you go to large economies such as Germany, it's only now that they are there. It tells you that you have a long, long journey. You go to the JSE and check how many women are sitting in the boards of this country. You go to the police service.
Uh-huh.
When I went there,
in
the 100 years of the existence of the police service, there was never a woman in that position.
Do you think there'll ever be another?
What I can say is that I do not care who says what. The ceiling has been shattered. The many young girls, history has been written.
Yeah.
And many women in this country, the many young women who are in the police service, know that it is possible, it can be done.
Yeah. You introduced it, I suppose.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I thank, you know, the opportunity to shatter that glass and to actually say it can be done and it should be done again.
So what did you do, actually, just to be specific, so that you share with us the
remember, those are the type of positions where you don't even you have to be asked.
Yeah.
I was asked to serve and asked a number of questions to say, actually, why do you think I would be the person to go there? Because first and foremost, I'm not a police.
Yeah. You're from the banking sector, I think. Yeah.
I was from a diverse sector. You know, I've been in transport, Transnet. I've been in Ports Authority. I've been in banking. I've been in the NGO sector. So I had done many, many things. So, but a lot of time I spent in the business sector.
Mm.
So when I was, and I chaired the Committee on SOEs, sat on Road Accident Fund commissions. I've done a lot of things in my life. So when I was asked, I actually said, but why me? Because I'm not in a police. And what I was told was that, listen, you don't understand why we are asking you. And I said, let me in. Why are you asking me?
Mm.
And then I was told that, look, the police service does not have a shortage of policing skills. But the police service is short of administrative skills, good governance skills, good management skills. And indeed, when I looked at my skill set and I looked at my CV to say, I'm a professional general manager, and it doesn't matter where you put me. You can give me any organization. I'll be able to come in and be able to use those skills to manage and govern. And I was also told that the constitution that empowers the president to appoint a person says the president can appoint a man and a woman, or a woman, to manage and administrate the police service. And then when I sat back and reflected, I actually said, maybe I'm missing something, because, you know, Fivers maybe came from the police service, but I'm told that he was in the support side. When I looked at Jackie Slaby, General Jackie Slaby, he wasn't a police person.
He
was a teacher, first a teacher, then a DG, a politician. I looked at Becky Cele, wasn't a police, was a teacher and a politician. So I started saying, maybe there is, you know, legitimacy in what has been asked. So ultimately, I relented and I said, maybe it's my time.
Must have been tough for you then, you know, let alone the fact that you're a woman and you didn't come from within the ranks, because I would imagine that there were career policemen within the ranks who, you know, to this day.
You see, that's the narrative. And I want to, and I'm repeating what I told you to say, the two DGs that I was following did not come from the ranks.
Yeah, but the perception.
That is why I said that. And the narrative at that point did not even go there.
Yeah.
And I mean, you take Petros in Gauteng. Teacher, maths teacher. So I want, and I kept on saying, the narrative is imaging. Because there's a woman leading the police service. And that was my argument in most instances. And I looked at it, and I looked at many others. I mean, the gentleman who was leading the operations, for that matter, of the police during 2010, came from UNISA as a strategy lecturer to lead operations of the police. And you've never had that narrative. Was a white gentleman, was there. You had never had that narrative. But the debates became violent and loud. And I kept on questioning myself. Is the debate about me being not from the ranks, or is the debate about me being a woman? Because I kept on saying to myself, I haven't had this debate with my other counterparts who were in the same position, who are male.
Yeah. What did you do for women, female police officers?
A lot of things. The first, you know, we had a women's associations at the police women association in the police service. And when I was national commissioner, 50% of the top 10, because the top 10 is made up of the national commissioner and nine provincial commission, 50% were women leading the police service in the provinces. I also ventured, you know, I also had the opportunity of chairing the SADC Association of Police Chiefs.
Yeah.
And I was the first woman to chair it.
Yeah.
Police chiefs.
Do you feel less appreciated with regards to this role that you played as a commissioner?
Not quite. Not quite. I understand what was going on in the narrative, but I guess it's not a question of being defined by the noise.
Yeah.
I understood what I was doing, and I understood that it was meaningful. And there was a lot of feedback from many other people, from my colleagues, from the service. But the noise outside, the media, the narrative,
We invited you to talk about this very important role that you play, which is about you as the CEO of Safer South Africa Foundation, which does wonderful work at schools. But the Marikana saga, I don't want to ask you a question. I want you to give me a narrative that you want all of us to understand in as far as what happened.
Maybe I'll say two or three or four things.
Yeah.
First and foremost, I will say it over and over again. If I have a voice from the grave, I will also say that again. It was the most unforgettable tragedy that befell this country. And my heart, my thoughts, and my memories goes to those who lost their lives there. Both pre the 16th, because 10 people lost their lives already.
Mm.
A lot of property was damaged. Many people were injured before the tragedy. And the narrative, unfortunately, does not focus on a number of those.
Focuses on the 34.
Yes. My heart goes out to everybody who lost their lives there. My heart goes out to the families of every one of those people, including of the fatal day, who have lost their lives there. And I believe, secondly, that there was a monumental systemic failure. And I'll tell you why I'm saying that.
Mm.
I'm saying that because I am saying the strike was elongated. It started around the 9th, and it was a violent strike.
Mm.
And in instances such as that, you would expect that there are role players there. There's, for instance, the Department of Labor.
Mm.
I am not sure whether I would sit here comfortably and say the intervention from there was sufficient, because when a strike is as violent as that, you are looking for not just police intervention. Mm-hmm. You're looking for other interventions to come on board. I also would like to look at the employer. If you look at the employer, the mind that employed these people, the issues they were complaining about required very resolute interventions. And considering the fact that even the negotiations that were taking place, some of them were not within their own agreed upon negotiation framework. And the issues that the employees were complaining about, I mean, the salaries, you go to Marikana, the same conditions of squalor and suffering remain. And my big question is, what happens to mining charters that are there to talk about not just employment, but also conditions of living, conditions of those employees? These are mines that are making lots and lots of money, and one could not, you know, but think, you know, very, 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 with a sore heart about those employees who are working there. I then shift to their unions, because the question of union rivalry is also a clear one. And we know, we read, we heard, we learned that there was tension even there. So I can go on and on and on and just say this was a huge systemic failure.
Yeah.
And you would not use the police as a first and last resort of solving such tensions and anger. And we also know that it was an angry, violent strike.
Yeah.
So even the response of the police, I would say, maybe they could have done better. We've just seen what happened at JP. There was a retreat, there was whatever. So a lot of those things.
Yeah.
I was sitting in.
Did you feel protected? Because it seems as if, in as far as senior officials are concerned in government, you're the only one who was taken to task.
I read a scripture called, you know, about the scapegoat, and I got to understand a little bit of that.
What does it say?
You know, when things are enormous and troubled, you choose a goat that you can load all your troubles on and send it into the wilderness. That's what that scripture says. And it's an analogy that I can relate to.
What does it mean?
It means you choose a person that can carry the burden
can go to the, to
for the
wilderness.
Nation and go to the wilderness.
Yeah. So is that how you look? Have you forgiven people? Have you, you know?
I appreciate the life that I've been given by God.
Would you go back?
So I would never waste my life with whatever. You know, you embrace what comes to you. The future doesn't belong to us.
Yeah.
At any given time, when something presents to you, you embrace it. But if you're a positive thinker in terms of your life, you deal with those issues and you go forward with your life.
Would you go back, given another chance?
Unfortunately, I'm a pensioner. I wouldn't do it again. But I'm doing other things and emptying my hands and making sure that I can share my life experiences in different ways.
That's exactly what we are going to speak about. 22 minutes after 9, Ria Pierre is our guest. We speak to her about her role as the CEO of Safer South Africa Foundation.
Authentic and honest conversations with Thabiso Kotane on Power 98.7.
25 minutes after 9. So let's talk about Safer South Africa Foundation. You are the CEO there. You know, look at the smile on your face. It seems as if you're enjoying yourself there. What's going on? What is this organization all about?
Beautiful, beautiful, beautiful organizations. Safer South Africa Foundation was founded by Pop Crew, the police union, at their national conference, I think, of 2011. They took a decision to establish this foundation. The reason they did that was to look at how, remember, they their members are the police, the traffic officers, and corrections people. Their thinking around this was that, yes, we are, you know, the union for these members. We're looking at their rights, we're looking at their working conditions. But they then thought, you know, because they have a business wing, to say what sort of a social responsibility can they embark upon, and the social responsibility which would still add value to their members. And the thought they had was, why don't we look at investing in communities so that communities can work hand in hand with this safety and security cluster to squeeze issues relating to crime and all those. And maybe to illustrate it, let me just talk about what I call a crime continuum. If you look at the continuum of crime, you would have the primary, the secondary, and the tertiary. At a tertiary level, that's where hectic activity is taking place. That's where people are arrested, people are processed through NPA, people are processed through the courts, people are incarcerated and all that. And that's where a lot of these officers are spending their time. But you would agree with me that by that time, this young person that we're talking about has crossed the line. The crime is committed, so that person is going to be processed. If you try and walk back to start saying, what's happening in the prevention space? And if you start hearing some of the correctional people saying, if you go to jails, almost the majority of the incarcerated people are young. So if you go to the primary level, That's where prevention is. At the tertiary level, it's proactive, it's reactive. The act has happened. This child is in trouble. This child is being processed. This child is going to jail. But at a prevention level, you're actually starting to ask yourself a question to say, come on, these children are not born criminals. These children are not born drug addicts. These children are not born knowing about working with Maginza or people who go for heists and all that. Somebody comes in, influences them and teaches them. Now, you ask yourself the question.
And somebody why is absent.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So why do we not take the opportunity, therefore, to teach? And that's negative teaching. Why do we not take the opportunity to teach positive skills that would assist them to help to make better choices in their lives? Because they understand that crime does not pay. They understand that, you know what, my life is ahead of me. And in fact, if I avoid the following, I am reducing the opportunity for me to do whatever. So we allow them to have better mothers who will teach them about drug trafficking and all those things, instead of saying to them, listen, my child, there's a problem there. We are not going to choose for you. But if you get to know and understand and make real choices, you empower the child, you empower the community, you empower the school, and then the children are able to make better choices because they are in that space. So we are playing in the primary level.
Yeah.
We are in the schools.
Mm-hmm.
We work with the security cluster. Because the secure, we don't even teach. We create the platform, we're the platform creators. And the entire security cluster works with us. These children are taught by the police. They're taught by the traffic officers. They're taught by, you know, officers from NPA. They're taught by people from the courts. They are taught by correctional service people. And in some instances, we then choose, in two instances, it's both academic as well as experiential. What we did was to reach out to say, we create the platform. The Department of Education, we have an agreement and understanding with them, basic education. So the school is a partner, the Department of Basic Education, with the principals and all that. And then the other partner are the police, South African Police Service, the Metro Police and the transport departments in the provinces, the NPA, Department of Justice through the magistrates, correctional service. We have the South African Human Rights Commission, because there's constitutional education, rights and responsibility for children. Our brand new partner is the Banking Association of South Africa, because we're saying financial inclusion is important. Positive skills with money, because the root of all even is money. Teaching them how to save, knowing that you can positively create your own resources and all those type of things. So part of the areas, so they come in, we've agreed with them to say, if you had an opportunity, you're police, what would you teach the children? If you had an opportunity and you are corrections, what would you teach the children? So we developed a framework, sort of a syllabus on how to do all this.
It sounds fantastic, but I'm interested in knowing, I suppose, how do you identify the schools and how do you identify the individual kids?
Okay. Maybe before we even go there, let me say to you that there's the academic side and then there's the practical side.
Yeah.
There are two areas that we've chosen for experiential learning. It's the courts and jail. So once they've been taught a lesson, it's an 11 session program. We do it after school so that we don't interfere
with
the school. The parents give us permission. The school give us permission, the SGB. After school, 2 hours, we serve them some little bit of refreshment so that they're not hungry and they're whatever. So we choose two experiential areas. On a different day, altogether. The children are carried to, are transported to a court to experience a life experience in court. If there is no court, the NPA and people in the Department of Justice do a full mock court for them to show them what it means and the experience of being there to understand. And when they come back, there's a lot of attitude change, behavior modification. They understand and they become ambassadors. They start talking about it. Then the other experiential one, they spend a day in jail to actually see how a jail works, to experience everything, see the cells, see the kitchen, see where people work and all that. And in all those, in most of those instances, they would even get the juvenile people, one or two speakers, to come and talk to the children. And you should see the essays they write. You should hear them give feedback about their own experiences. You should hear them addressing the other children in assembly about what they've learned. The feedback we get from the parents, they keep on saying to us, what did you do to these children? Yeah. Because they've been empowered.
Sounds fantastic. So like I said, I mean, how do you then identify the schools? And how do you then identify the students?
Okay.
You know, is it as per a recommendation of the teachers, perhaps, to say maybe this group will be...
Let me start with identifying the schools. Firstly, it could be... We have provincial coordinators who are in the provinces. And firstly, it would be maybe a community asking... knowing about us and requesting that we come to their school. Secondly, it could be an incident that has caught the minds of the nation, like the Ramotsere High School, where Elena killed a teacher. And we thought those are children who are, you know, at the secondary level, high risk. Or it could be a school where there's a lot of gangsterism, where we think their exposure to the security cluster and listening to those professionals talking to them. It could be a school where you request because you are doing something. It could be a school where a company is working in that community and they say, we would pay for a program. Come and assist us. We use diverse approaches. We don't identify the children. Because we have an understanding with the Department of Education, when we get to that school, the principal will appoint a school coordinator that will work with our coordinator. They'll identify the 80 or 40 children for that session. And then they would write to the parents to notify them that there is such and such a program. Would like us to you to give us permission for your children to participate. They will talk to the SGB and then we'll have a full briefing of all those senior stakeholders before we even start with the children.
So I'm asking you this because I was in the last 2 to 3 weeks I've been focusing through the show on the issue in the Western Cape and the deployment of the soldiers. And I spoke to the MEC for safety in the Western Cape, who says, look, we can deploy the army all we need. We can bolster the police all we need. But at the end of the day, if we don't change the socioeconomic conditions of the areas we are in, then you know we will continuously lose the fight. Is it something that you agree on?
Look, the philosophy is right. You need a blend of everything because we are having, you know, a whole spectrum of things. There are crimes that are already happening. There are children who are growing up in those areas. There are children who are at high risk. So a blend of all those things. If you just have the army there and you are not investing in prevention and mobilizing communities to come on board, you are a clear loser. So we really need an integrated and a highly consolidated strategy to deal with this. And it's got to be all hands on deck. But we need to be talking to each other to start saying, what are the offerings that are bringing in prevention? you know, support in terms of crime and community standing up to come there. And remember, Tabiso, the first police station is the home. I always said that when I was in the police service. When you get into your house at night, now you want to know whether all doors are locked, cars are parked, the gates are closed. Are all the children in the house?
Yeah.
When you wake up in the morning and these children have to go to school and transport is collecting them, you don't just throw them at any other taxi. You want to know who collects my children.
Mm.
And you want, surely you'd be having a level of comfort knowing that the taxi, that transporter is of Mr. Mutwening and Mr. Mutwening lives at such and such a place. If I have a problem, I can pick up a phone and call Mutwening.
Mm.
When children are playing in the street during the day, you, if there's a tavern down the street, you'll be saying, don't play that side, don't play that side, play that. So the home and the community has as much a stake in playing in this. So
it's interesting all of us you must say come that, on board. Because we don't play that role as parents. We bury our heads in the sand. You know, somebody says, hey, Spoo has got a friend who is a transporting kid. Speak to him. He charges favorably. Then we get him. He picks up the child. That's it, you know.
Would taverns
open, and our children, even some community members, send kids to go and buy cigarettes, they're in the beer. Some kids even go look for their parents, they're in the taverns. And, you know, it becomes normal in our society, isn't it?
So you're actually raising a pertinent issue. So the question is, where are you in the fight against crime?
Yeah.
It is... Fighting crime is a duty of all citizens. It can never be the duty of police alone.
Yeah.
You know, I remember a few years ago when I was still at the police, we spoke to a senior police officer from Brooklyn in the US. And he was saying to us, some years ago, they used to have crime levels that were scary. Their statistics were scary. And many people were feeling helpless about the situation. Mm. And he said, you know, a few years down the line, 18, 20 years down the line, they were asking themselves, what happened? Why are we having now these statistics that are showing reduction in crime? There is a lot of freedom. People are walking around and all that. And we were saying to him, what actually happened? And he said, you know, it was the small efforts by the church, by the sports club, by the families. Everybody was doing something because they were overwhelmed by what was happening out there, the big problem.
Mm.
So you retreat to the small program, area to say, what am I doing in my house? What are we doing in our church to make sure that our youths, you know, are safe from the nyaupe and all those things? What are we doing in our sports, whatever?
Yeah.
And it was, and that tells you about communities also coming to the party. And that it becomes all hands on deck. Then we will be able to squeeze crime.
Yeah.
And I think it is the space we find ourselves in as a country. So every little effort matters.
Yeah. So is your focus in schools? To what extent do you also look into communities as well? Because I can imagine this wonderful program targeting children. They go there, they come back with their minds having been altered for the better. And then they go back to the same communities.
Yes. Look, we just had our strategic session last week, and we were looking at a number of things. Maybe let me just add a few things that would show you that we're trying to expand what we're doing.
Mm.
These children, after finishing an 11-day program taught by all these people that I've told you, the final session is offered by the banks where they teach them. It's a smart saver program.
Mm-hmm.
They teach them how to save.
Mm-hmm.
They teach them how to relate with money, and it's a financial inclusion thing. You know, when we were growing up, I think up until I started working, I had no clue on what to do in a bank.
Yeah,
I had no clue about the investment opportunities that are the bonds and all those type of things.
Yeah.
And children who are in environments where conversations are taking place between parents, they know that there's something called an insurance. They know that there's something buying shares. Imagine children who are coming from disadvantaged homes where parents don't even talk that when are they going to start participating in financial inclusion. So this type of program also assists them to be able to be closer to conversations that matter for their future, for participating in the economy and all that. So I'm just using that as an example. So when they finish, all these children, we don't let them write an exam or whatever. We ask them to do an essay to show us, you know, give us a high level of appreciation of what they've learned, number one, and also tell us how they are going to contribute towards a fighting crime, them personally, what their school should do, what their community should do. Very interesting essays. Most of them do not have computers. They use foolscaps and their hands, and we take them raw as they are.
Yeah.
And we, at the award ceremony where we recognize all of them and give them certificates, we select the best three essays. What we will be launching next year. And they also choose somebody to represent the school. So we and normally somebody they have confidence in who's able to eloquent and able to present things. So all those children who have been selected, we are launching a national debate and dialogue around safety and security. It will be taking place in March next year, and it will be an annual thing. Each March, we would like youth to converse about issues of crime. So all children who, all schools that participated from the Free State, Western Cape and whatever, I think we'll be having a convergence of about 300, 350 children to dialogue around that, because we want to build a movement of talking about crime and crime ambassadors that will grow into this as we go on.
How widespread are you in as far as the landscape of the country is concerned?
Look, we're in 9 provinces now with the first set of coordinators, and each one of them do at least 8 schools in each province with 90 children. So we're hoping to train more volunteers to assist to reach out to other areas. That's one. And then the other things that we do, for instance, here in Gauteng in September, we'll be participating in something called Silent Walk. These are children who are deaf. It's a walk supporting the deaf community, because we also picked up from their teachers and their schools that they hardly even go and report crimes committed against them, because nobody's able to talk their language and all that. So with the security cluster partners, we'll be going there, you know, through their translators to offer this program to create awareness and do whatever. So we joined. So we do walks, we do runs. So the first one that we have joined hands with other partners is this one. The, it will be taking place at the at the at Zoo Lake.
What about the psychological effect? Because I remember when I was working in Limpopo, I mean, one of the teachers was saying that another important aspect of looking into this gangsterism issue is the anger that these kids have got to deal with on a day-to-day basis, because they are living in child-headed families. They don't know where the mother is. They know the mother is somewhere in Gauteng. They don't know where the father is or who the father is. And all of these things, they make them so aggressive to a point where even the poverty that they're in makes them feel as if they've got nothing to lose.
Okay. I'm going
to
give
use
you
it to their own.
I'm going to give you 2 stories of children who were part of the program. And that's a secondary process now. Remember, we went to the school to create awareness, to give them skills and all that. I'll talk about a young man called Tando from a school in Tembisa. When we went for the award ceremony, he was selected by his peers to be their speaker for the day. When he stood up on the podium, he said to everybody, "I am truly grateful for this program. I was part of a gang up until this program came. As I went through this program and we finished, I went to my gang and told them that I am no longer part of you. We recently had an international conference for financial inclusion, and the Banking Association offered us an opportunity to invite one learner. We went to invite Thando, and we had the opportunity then of going to Thando's home. When we went to Thando's home, your tears would just tell you that no wonder this child found himself in the space that he was in. It was the smallest shack I've seen, with one bed and a very dilapidated sofa, with a grandmother and the sister who has a child. There's no fridge, there's no stove, there's nothing. There is nothing. And here's a child who had found survival and recognition via gangs. But through this program, he has decided that I'm no longer going there. So when we went to the school to check, can he use his uniform, you know, to wear, because it was a three-day international conference and all that, the principal said to us, even the uniform is a challenge. So we started just going, dipping into our pockets to say, let's make it good for this child. People came on board, we bought groceries for the family. But the young man is determined. What he has learned through that process, he has decided that he's not looking back. You know, I watched him at that conference giving radio interviews about what has changed his life. I watched him and, you know, preaching out to people, and, you know, it just sent goosebumps on me.
Yeah.
And he was saying, is this the food we're going to have? Because he couldn't, just seeing the spread of buffet, he was, and it's those type of things that tells you something else. He now has a bursary, ready to go to the university, he's working extremely hard. So I just want to show you the starfish philosophy. Yes, 1,000 are a wash. But if we do our bit to pick up the few and throw back, would go a long way.
Yeah.
In Cape Town, one of our coordinators was telling us a story last week when we met, to say, you know, I went to this place. This child, after the program, said to the coordinator, I have to leave. Transport is going. She said, no, I'll take you home. They had given them, you know, these small dumpy things?
Yes.
The cool drink ones.
Yes.
She had a sip. And she says, I gulped mine.
Yeah.
She had a sip.
Small, those things. Yeah.
She had a sip, one, two, and she closed it tightly.
Yeah.
She said, I was curious. I then asked, why are you closing that? And then she said, I have to share with my two siblings back home. Then I got very concerned. And I said, I'm not this to be shared by three people. And this child to even want to take this small bottle home. I must see where this child comes from. When she got there, it was a shack which had no roof, which had plastics all over. It was a child-headed household. No parents.
Yeah.
But this child still goes to school.
This thing of child-headed families, it requires a lot of attention in this country, isn't it?
So she, a lot of attention. So she started mobilizing. She was going to do a 21st birthday for one of her children. And the child said, take whatever you have to go and buy boards. Let's roof that house. Let's do whatever. And many people have come on board. They've bought them beds. They've bought them whatever. But I just want to show you that even through this program, we're able to reach children that we inadvertently were not going to meet.
Yeah.
We meet them inadvertently. Yeah. But I just want to say to you, but the positive attitude, if you look at that child and you look at what they are thinking and where they are going.
Yeah.
Suddenly.
Am I hearing you to be also saying that when we look at these children, we must not see these young monsters. We must also try to understand the psychological and the orientation that they come from as well. Because we ignore it. We yes. just shake our heads and say, hey, kwano khotlaetse man. Alamunyane so. But we don't take the time to understand.
Not at all.
These 13, 14, 15-year-olds. Because we even often forget that these are kids at the end of the day.
I listened to a girl in Ramotsir, in this school that we went to 2 weeks ago. Or a week ago? A week ago. The girl who represented them said, I thank this program for the opportunity that it has given me. I never thought that I would recover myself. That's what she said. And she was saying, I was part of a gang. Yeah. And I think that gang, that the place is in, has a lot of gangsterism. So, and she was saying, I led my life so recklessly. But now I know that I have a future. And I looked at her. She was a little bit rough, but you can see, and she's in matric, and she's saying, you will come to my graduation. And it's a starfish that yeah. would have been lost.
Yeah. I'm getting a lot of abuse for not opening the lines, but I'm going to allow, and I think you should be back. Miles in Nigel wants to speak to you. Miles, good evening.
Thank you, my brother, for taking my call.
Thank you.
I'm not sure whether your guest is from a non-profitable organization or is she from government.
Isn't it an NPO?
It's an NPO. All we're doing is we're collaborating with
government.
Those who have the skills to assist us.
Now, you see, in 2004 already, we funded as a South African Prisoners Organization for Human Rights, and we identified a project called Anti-Gangsterism, Anti-Bullying, Anti-Alcohol Substance Abuse, Anti-Drugs, Anti-Violence, Anti-Sexual Violence, Anti-Teenage Pregnancy, Anti-School Dropout, and ultimately Anti-Suicide. And these were ex-offenders that were out on parole and they were actively being monitored and they were trained by an organization called, an accredited service provider called ADEL Training Academy to become mentors, trained mentors and motivational speakers, and the standard qualification was an NQF level 4. You see, we have, lost an opportunity since then because petty politicking got involved into that project and it fell apart. Wow. And all those 12 ex-offenders that were trained, I'm talking about trained ex-offenders, to be mentors and motivational speakers, it fell apart and the lot stopped funding us because of petty politicking. And by the way, we have grown very wary about motivational speakers and mentors that are not trained and have not done the necessary standard qualifications to a certain NQF level 4. Because our project was about connecting what you see with the Department of Social Development, Education, Arts and Cultures, Community Safety, and so on, and monitor it because it is where the kid comes from, the community and his household, that is in fact the root cause of what you see, rebelliousness within these children when they are at school. But it all fell into no man's land because of petty, dirty politicking of people who believe in witchcraft.
Yeah. So what do you want to say to our guest tonight, Mapiaga?
I want to know whether these things that they are doing, the people that they are using as mentors and motivational speakers, are these people trained? Are they professional people that end up graduating and use that training as a profession to be mentors and motivational speakers and then keep government accountable in terms of implementing projects that will let that kid come out of that morass?
Okay, Miles, thank you very much. And after responding to Miles, people that are listening to this conversation that want to be part of what you are doing as a Safer South Africa Foundation, where do they contact and how do they contact you?
Okay. I want to say to Miles, we are not training professional motivational speakers. We are creating awareness amongst ordinary learners so that they are able to make better choices.
Mm-hmm.
But in the process, because they write essays and there are conversations, they are then empowered to be able to express their views around this. And the debate is meant largely not to create motivational speakers, but to create dialogue around issues relating to crime, because they then become ambassadors. You know, one of the parents was saying to us, since the child finished the program, every little opportunity she gets to talk to her cousins, to her neighbors, to her friends, to say, you know what, do not commit crime. Crime does not pay.
Yeah. Well, thank you, ma'am. We really appreciate your time. Where do people contact you?
We have a website, Safer South Africa Foundation.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's info@safersouthafrica.org.
Okay. info@safersouthafrica.org.
Yeah.
But no, Safer South Africa. Org, just org, no?
I think it's, yeah.
That, well, I think if people Google it, they will find it anyway.
Yes.
Thank you for coming through. And thank you for reminding us about the burden that we place on our children as well. And I think, you know, the issue of child-headed family is something that we need to spend another hour on and just talk about how do we wipe it off? You know, what do we do with those children? You know, and what role do we play as a society? You know,
very
people
crucial.
Who live in that society.
Very crucial.
Do you take these kids and put them in a family structure or in a government structure or in, or do you get do you get people in their surrounding houses to become the parent? You know, we need to find a solution because it is festering, particularly in rural areas. You know, where parents have simply walked away for whatever reason. Some maybe good reason, because the mother is just alone. You know, got to go out there and fend off, find solutions to support the kids and stuff like that. But it's a big problem.
And I think it's important for us to realize that. You know, in IT speak, they say garbage in. It's garbage out. We cannot franchise the responsibility totally to the teachers. We have to at least give the teachers a starting chance by playing our part at home.
Yeah.
So that by the time the children go to school, we are supported by those surrogate parents who are supporting parenting and responsibility that is taking place at home.
Absolutely.
I know there were two principals. I don't know if you'll still be talking to them.
Yeah,
because they were going to give you a live experience.
Yeah. I think we tried to get hold of them. But what we'll do is that we'll make separate time for them as well. And I hope you'll be back again soon. Because
I definitely
a lot of people have been calling in wanting to engage you. But we just, for some reason, did not have enough time. But thank you very much, man. Thanks for coming.
I really do. Thank you for this. And just remember that you're angels that carry our voices everywhere.
Thank you, ma'am. We really appreciate your kind words as well. Let's go to news at 10.
You've been listening to a Power 98.7 podcast. For more podcasts, visit power987.co.za or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.